Ezekiel Kralin read a post to the MCN announced listserv about the value of consciously practicing gratitude, that talked about a link between gratitude and physical health. And I don't have that. I don't know why I don't have that, but I have his reply to it, and here it is. Ezekiel Kralin wrote, "However, if you can't muster up any gratitude, you're just beating your head on the wall, because faking it is bound to cause a harmful backfire. In fact, being honest with your feelings is the healthiest way to be, happy or no. I certainly have no gratitude for living in a city where the homeless are in your face 24/7 and street thugs are casing everyone's houses and breaking in and sometimes turning violent or at least acting out in threatening ways. I feel no gratitude for the collapse of this planet from population overshoot and catastrophic climate change and the coming blue ocean event, nor do I contain even one smidgen of gratitude for lack of decent health care for myself and the millions of others, or for all the mass shootings across this nation, most often at public schools populated by vulnerable youth, or for all the corruption of government under Donald Trump, increasing at a rapid pace, dismantling what remains of our tenuous democracy. It is very stressful living on a low income in this nation, let alone in a hyper-expensive city. I have no gratitude for a brother who has turned into a raving pro-Trump conspiracy lunatic. He is dangerous. And on it goes. I have attempted to feel gratitude for what good things there are in my life, but the big picture refuses to vanish because I just know better. I'm certainly not about to swallow the happiness cult Kool-Aid. That is like a contest where the winners are those who achieve the most convincing behavior in stories about how joyful they, quote, really are, and the rest of us are losers to be scorned and spit upon. I know better. Most of them are fakes. Life is what it is. I don't like it very much, but I accept it. And I see no point in pretending otherwise, which would, ironically, just exacerbate my already displeased nature. I am sure I will die displeased. Big Farkin, F-A-R-K-I-N, Farkin deal. At least I stand in the company of many great thinkers and philosophers who feel the same way I do, and I think, well, that ain't too shabby now, is it? And then he gave a link to a TED Talk by a woman named Keely, K-E-E-L-Y, Herron, H-E-R-R-O-N, called Leaving the Cult of Happiness. And I have it right here. Let me just, I think I have it here. Hold on just a moment. Bear with me for a moment while I see if I can. Yeah. I should have it here, but I don't. Oh, no, I do. It's not under her name. It's under TED. That explains it. Usually if it's a TED Talk, it's got brackets around the TED, and that brings it to the top of the aisle. So, yeah, this is almost 14 minutes long, and I think it's totally worth it, and I'm going to play it for you right now. K-N-Y-O-L-P, Fort Bragg, K-M-E-C-L-P, Ukiah, back in about 14 or 15 minutes or so with more Memo of the Year Goodnight Radio. And again, I'll be here until 5 o'clock in the morning, so don't go away.
I was on a road trip recently with one of my best friends, and we were listening to The Tim Ferriss Show. It's a podcast that's been downloaded about 80 million times, and he wrote the New York Times best-selling book, The 4-Hour Workweek. So Tim is talking to Vince Vaughn, the actor of Wedding Crasher fame, on the podcast, and they're talking about how Tim didn't learn to swim until he was about 30 years old, because as a kid, he was bullied at summer camp, and he almost drowned. And as a result, he was deeply traumatized and terrified of water, and he just never learned to swim. And this shamed him. He felt really bad about that. But he did eventually learn to swim, and he talked about it. And on this particular podcast that I was listening to, Vince was telling Tim how inspired he was by Tim's story of overcoming his trauma and learning to swim. And I'm listening to this story with my friend, driving in the car somewhere on I-90 in South Dakota. And I say out loud, "Oh, poor Tim Ferriss. He was bullied as a kid and he never learned to swim, but then he did, and that was so inspiring." Said that out loud. And my friend looks at me like, you're a horrible person. And I'm like, yeah, I got nothing. So we just kind of turned off the podcast and sat in uncomfortable silence for a few minutes. But it really bugged me. And when things really bug me, I need to like lean into them and get in there and figure out why. So a couple days later, maybe a week later or something, I was talking with my counselor. And we're trying to figure out why I was so bothered by this. And we came to the conclusion that I got mad because not only did Tim overcome his trauma and talk about it publicly, when he did, he was met with compassion, his pain was validated, and even better, somebody thought it was inspiring. But that still wasn't good enough for me. I was like, but bullying, really? That's like an acceptable trauma. And what I mean by an acceptable trauma is, acceptable traumas are things that people can relate to. They're things that when you say them out loud, people know how to respond. Something like a dog dying, or losing a parent, or getting bullied as a kid. We all know that those things suck. And we know that you can go, oh God, I'm sorry, that must have been really hard. But if those are acceptable traumas, what are unacceptable traumas? Unacceptable traumas are the things that people can't or don't want to relate to. That when you say them out loud, they recoil, they grimace, they get uncomfortable visibly. You can see it in their face. So when I tell people that my dad killed himself, people tend to get a little bit uncomfortable. And I can see them squirming. And when I tell them that, imagine what they look like when I tell them that I was raped when I was 16. Or that I was first sexually abused when I was 5. So that feeling that you might be having right now, like, oh, I don't like that. That's a reaction to stigma. Stigma is a badge of shame. And sometimes it's a literal badge of shame, like an armband that a certain group of people are forced to wear, or a separate bathroom that a certain group of people are forced to use. And other times it's more figurative. It's more social. So if we're having a conversation with someone and they bring up a subject that we're not comfortable with, we just don't talk about it. We force that person to just kind of live with that shame on their own. And they just have to kind of suck it up and deal with it. Sexual abuse. Rape. Mental illness. And suicide. These are my unacceptable stigmatized traumas. And they're horrible. I would not wish them on anyone. But they're mine, and I can't undo them. As much as I've tried, believe me, I have tried to just be like, la, la, la. Doesn't, la, 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 la. It doesn't work that way. So that reaction that I had to the Tim Ferriss show, where I was all judgy and angry and weird, that was my trauma and my shame popping up like some weird trauma whack-a-mole game. Like, I'm perfect, but no, you're not, because the trauma just pops up at weird places and embarrasses you and makes you sound like a jerk. And I started thinking about my reaction to that, and as I was working through it, I was thinking about how I have this need to just pretend that I'm perfect. And in Tim Ferriss's case, his trauma seemed like it wasn't as bad as mine. I got out this measuring stick and I said, his trauma isn't as horrible as mine, but yet when he talks about it, he gets compassion. And when I talk about mine, overwhelmingly in the past, it hasn't necessarily been a compassionate response where people are like, oh, you know, that was so inspiring that you survived all that gross stuff. It's like, oh, I don't want to talk about it. Please don't talk about it. So I learned to not talk about it. And I learned to be as perfect as I could possibly be. And I pursued perfection like it was my job. And I wore that perfection like armor. And I needed you to see the person that I wanted you to see, who I thought was perfect. Because underneath that armor of perfection, I was a hot mess. So I'm working through this, and I start to think about it. Like, why do I need to be perfect? Why is it that we have to only show this happy, shiny side of ourselves and deny that there's any problems? And, oh, if there is, like, a small problem, it's okay to talk about it in retrospect, like, after it's done. Because then we can all, like, be like, yay, you survived, and that's so inspiring. But it's like the Hollywood ending. We can't deal with something that's not wrapped up with a bow. So like in real life, when the protagonist dies alone in the Arctic, maybe gets eaten by a bear or has some other tragic ending, in the Hollywood version, he marries a sweetie and they live happily ever after. And I started to refer to this phenomenon as the cult of happiness. So the cult of happiness has been around forever. It's just that now with social media, we can project how perfect we are to everybody, so that I think that I'm the only person that's like sitting at home eating Pringles while everybody else is like in Italy posting gorgeous photos of themselves with inspirational quotes and all these things, and there's like 17 hashtags, and it's like blessed, gratitude, like wisdom. It's like, oh, thank God the universe is looking out for me on my vacation to Italy. But it really bugs me because I don't get it. Like, for me, it's not, I love Italy. I mean, Rome is my favorite city, which I didn't think it would be, but it is actually my favorite city. I love the happy stuff, but for me, I also have this like massive dark side, and I drag it around with me everywhere. And I wish I could just get rid of it, but I can't. And it's, I feel like if I were to post all these happy, amazing things on Instagram, I'd just be an imposter. Because, you know, going back to that whack-a-mole thing, I'm like, hey, look at me, I'm in Italy. And then it's like, oh, these trauma things pop up and I need to just whack them down. So meanwhile, I'm playing this whack-a-mole and chasing perfection and pretending I'm perfect. And meanwhile, my shame and my trauma are just festering like dog poop in a Smith's bag, in a Ziploc bag, in a mason jar that I tie, you know, screw the top on as tight as I can, and then I just carry it around with me, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm just holding the mason jar of poop, no big deal. You, no, pay no attention, look away, avert your gaze. It's not a jar of poop here that I'm carrying around. Just festering. But what if I had taken that crap, and instead of lacking it up and carrying it around with me and trying to pretend it's not there, what if I had just laid it out in the sun and let the wind and the rain and the light transform it? It might not have been gone completely, but it would have changed and it would have become lighter. It would have been transformed. Robert Frost wrote, "The best way out is always through." And I have clung to that through many, many dark nights of the soul. And during trying to work through all this stuff, there was a lot of like, why me? Like, why do I have to have all these horrible things happen to me when everybody else is like in Italy being blessed? Stuff like, oh, I'm just gonna eat my Pringles. And so this girlfriend of mine that I was on the road trip with, we're still friends, even though she still kind of thinks I'm a horrible person. She sends me this quote that says, "What if the word victim could be redefined as something closer to hero, so that the path some have tread would spare others from the same?" I thought, okay, haven't heard that one before. Hero, not a victim, not a survivor. I don't know why I hate that word, I just do. But a hero. So if I'm a hero, I should have a superpower. If I have a superpower, I guess it's going to be to defeat stigma. And as a self-proclaimed superhero, my first act in my fight against stigma is to introduce an alternative to the cult of happiness. In the cult of compassion, all of those bright, shiny, happy things are good. Bring them on over. Totally cool. We love it. But all those ugly, sticky, messy things that we kind of keep out of the cult of happiness, those are accepted too. And they're honored and they're supported and they're talked through and they're transformed into something that's maybe a little bit closer to authentic happiness. So I can tell my story tonight because I've done a lot of work since I moved to Jackson Hole 3.5 years ago when I just packed it all up and decided to live the dream, because it is a dream, right? I've done a lot of work, and so to spare you guys, I mean, maybe you're not going to do as much work as I would have done, but maybe you've got some work to do. But to spare you maybe a little bit of time, I can tell you what I learned from all of this. Listening, bearing witness to another's suffering, is not a passive practice. It's an act of healing. And I have been healed by some of the people in this room tonight who listened to my story. They bared witness to my suffering. They didn't reject me. They didn't tell me it was going to be okay. They just listened. And they didn't judge. It works. The cult of compassion works. And all of us here can be heroes. We can work together to defeat stigma, and we can help people heal. All it takes is an open mind, or an open heart if you're right-brained. Just shut your mouth and listen. And by listening, we can all together change the world. Because the truth is, we are all broken. It's just a question of how much and where. And as Leonard Cohen famously sang, there is a crack in everything. It's where the light gets in. Thanks for listening.